here's what the talk's about. It's three parts. First, I want to give a fairly elementary talk about deletion contraction relations, so we can relate the chromatic polynomial, the top polynomial, to the thing that we was talking about in the last talk. And then we want to see how this leads to some statistical mechanical models, for example, hard hexagons and other things. And then finally, I want to talk about how these different state summations that show up in topology are instances of a more general construction. We don't have to guess them, we can kind of derive them in a sort of unified framework. Okay, now in a show of solidarity with the other mathematicians, I'm not giving a Blackboard talk, but I am in your ideal transparency talks. And I apologize if this is dark. I haven't done things this way before, now, so hopefully people can see it. I've got this clicker here, but it hasn't been working very well. Okay, so we want to, this is part one, deletion contraction. We want to look at graph invariance, and I'm going to use a slightly general notion of the graph. I allow, you know, multiple edges between vertices. I allow bare vertices, edges that connect a vertex to itself, and I'll even allow an edge, a circular edge with no vertices. That's what I mean by graph. I want to consider a graph invariant that satisfies a deletion contraction relation like this for general coefficients A, B, and C. And I'm assuming A, B, and C are all non-zero. And one thing we should notice that is if we adjust our graph invariant by edge and vertex fugacities, replace I with something where we just put in factors according to the number of edge and vertices, then the new deletion, this graph invariant also satisfies a deletion contraction relation, and its coefficients transform as follows. And since those three coefficients were arbitrary up to a scalar anyway, it means that up to these fugacities, all deletion contraction relations are the same. There's only one if we're willing to adjust our invariant by edge and or vertex fugacities. So the moral will be, if we have two different graph invariants and they both satisfy the deletion contraction relation, then they must be very closely related. So in order to fully evaluate the graph, we need more than just that relation. The deletion contraction relation allows us to reduce the graph whose connected components have at most one vertex. So we need a way to eliminate edges, so we'll just assume that gives us the factor of lambda. We need to be able to evaluate a bare vertex, so we'll assume that gives a factor of p. And we need to evaluate this vertex, the edge without a vertex, we'll assume that gives a factor of l. And it may seem redundant that we've got two different factors, l and lambda, telling us how to get rid of edges, and we'll fix that in the next slide. And then for convenience, if we delete sort of a twig or a co-loop, whatever you want to call those things, that can be expressed in terms of the other things. So I'm going to define a factor of t, which is this combination of the other parameters. Okay, so now let's consider the following linear combination of things. Think of this as living in a vector space associated to a disk that has two edges coming into it, and up to deletion contraction, this sort of space of things we can put here is three-dimensional, because we can kill any freestanding components, we can kill any edges that are contained entirely within the disk. So the only thing that's left over is an edge going all the way across, an edge with a single vertex in the middle, and a couple of disconnected edges. And so what we have then is a little three-dimensional commutative algebra of gluing these things together. And we want to rewrite that algebra in terms of its idempotents, and one of the idempotents is n. So if you were to do that, that would lead you to naturally to this combination. And we notice that this, of the three idempotents, this one is almost nilpotent, in the sense that if we plug it in to a graph and the two external edges are connected to different vertices, we always get zero. And if the two external edges are connected to the same vertex, again, we always get zero. But if we just connect them to themselves in a circular pattern, it's nothing we've said so far, none of the relations that we've specified so far tells us that it's zero. But it really ought to be zero, so we impose a further relation, just declaring that to be zero. And then that means that this combination of the coefficients has to come out to zero. That's a zero, not a loop. And so this is, you can think of this as a relation between L and lambda.
Sorry, T was which one?
T was the, that's
oh, that's that combination, okay.
Yeah, T, so if we delete an edge, we get a factor of a freestanding edge. Okay, so now, so at this point we've, this is sort of the most general possible graph invariant that that's multiplicative under disjoint union. I think that was on the previous slide, but I forgot to say the words. And that obeys some pretty reasonable properties. Let me just comment parenthetically that if we didn't impose this, then what we could do is just assign the bare loop any value we wanted to, because none of the other relations, they all work things in terms of vertices, so all, you're not going to affect the deletion-contraction relation if you assign the vertex less, the loop without a vertex, any value you want to. So this relation is just eliminating that minor degree of freedom. Okay, so now let's find well-known graph invariants and fit them into, match them up with these parameters. So the chromatic polynomial satisfies this relation. I think Paul mentioned it in his talk. So that's A equals 1, B equals negative 1, C equals 1 in terms of the other things. If we have a self-connecting loop, that is, becomes uncolorable. So lambda is equal to 0. There's k ways for coloring with k colors, k ways to color a vertex. So p is equal to k, t is equal to k. And then we can check that this loop value, how many ways are there to color the vertices on a graph that has no vertices, and there are k of them. Just like this. The Tuck polynomial. I should have remarked earlier that so in essence we had a four-parameter family of graph invariants, and you can think of two of those parameters as having to do with vertex and edge weightings, and then a two-parameter family for choosing the deletion contraction relation. And then up to fugacities, it's only a two-parameter family, and this Tuck polynomial has two variables, so we think of this to be a pretty general polynomial that anything is expressible in terms of the Tuck polynomial. We won't be talking much about the Tuck polynomial, so I'll let this slide speak for itself. And finally, we can use the Templer-Leib algebra, which is, you can think of it as this Kaufman-Bracket polynomial where we don't allow crossings, but I guess in this form it goes back even earlier in Templer-Leib. Who was the first? Were you the first one to notice that this Templer-Leib had a graphical interpretation?
I think so. But a precursor to that is the Brouwer algebra, where the lines were written sort of in funny ways above and below the dots.
But the dots also appear in Baxter's book.
Okay.
Without quite the same implications, but the same kind of pictures appear. It's just clusters of boundaries and plus clusters. So.
Okay.
You do the Fortuyn-Castelein expansion of the POTS model, which is what Templer-Leib were studying to begin with, then you get the same.
Okay.
So it wasn't stated in this fashion, but it's the same.
Okay. Well, I think it's standard these days to refer to this as when you draw pictures like this without crossings, they're called Templer-Leib. That's what I'm going to do. I guess there's also this term d-isotopy because we eliminate loops. The value of d. Okay, so what we want to do is take this and we want to construct a graph invariant that satisfies a deletion contraction relation. That's going to be a little bit more involved. So first, choose arbitrary complex numbers u and v. Let's assume they're not zero. And then we want a blob whose square gives us this linear combination, u times this picture plus v times that picture. And the two-point algebra is it's a two-dimensional abelian semi-simple algebra, so we can always take square roots. So we don't really care what the coefficients of the blob is, we just know that it squares to this. And we're also going to choose a vertex for gas and beta. Okay, so at this point we actually have we have four parameters. We have u, v, beta, and then we've got this value d for the thing. So we've got enough parameters to sort of make this give us any graph invariant that has dilution contraction. And now we define the graph invariant by these substitutions. If the graph has an edge, we substitute a double edge in the red temporal leaf stuff. And for a vertex, sort of put the star-shaped thing, we put a red blob on each of the things. And remember, a red blob is some linear combination of the two possible crossingless pictures we could put in there. Special cases, if we have a bare vertex, that just gets a little red loop times beta. We have a univariant vertex, it looks like that. Okay, so this satisfies a deletion contraction relation. If we take this linear combination of the three graphs and we write it out, then sort of by design, this comes out to be zero, so we have a deletion contraction with a equals one, b equals negative b, c equals negative beta u. And then we can evaluate our other parameters, p is beta times d, l is d squared, this will be important, remember this one. And lambda is equal to something. And we can check that this relation here that sort of kills that little nilpotent guy is satisfied here, as you would expect, because this relation, which we opposed earlier, is just sort of making the thing behave more like a TQFT. And this, you know, to begin with, was a TQFT. So it would be very, very surprising if it didn't hold. Okay, so now we've got, so we should be able to choose these parameters. And so the obvious thing to do is we can express the chromatic polynomial or the Tupp polynomial in terms of temporally leaf stuff. So let's find out exactly what coefficients we should put there. So we match up the Tupp calculation with this one, and we come up with these values. And I should say this has been known. I think the usual statement is that the Jones polynomial, where that red blob might be a crossing, or maybe square root of a crossing, that's where you usually hear this stated. So this is almost nothing. A lot of what I'm saying here isn't new, but I don't know that it exists in exactly this form in the literature. So that's why it was worth restating. Okay, here's the Tupp polynomial, the chromatic polynomial. Something interesting happens. We match up the coefficients. You know, so here are our temporal leaf parameters. Here are our chromatic polynomial parameters. We end up with these things. So that means that the square of the loop value, the temporal leap loop value, should be the number of colors. The vertex of your gasity should be the loop value d. V equals 1 and u equals negative 1 over d. So that if you put two red blobs together, it's equal to the same. This d is the lowercase delta that we was talking previously. So what we have is a two-strand projector turned on the side, hooked up like that. So that means, and so the projector, there's some of its characteristic properties we mentioned last time. That means if we take a graph, and here I've, so a little bit of foreshadowing, I've drawn the dual graph, and then we make substitutions according to our recipe earlier, and now we just sort of isotope these red strands from the edges to the dual edges, we end up with this picture. And so what this means is that if putting it all together, if we take the chromatic polynomial of a graph for d squared colors, and I should have mentioned the number of colors, of course, doesn't have to be an integer. You can, you know, recursion makes sense for any parameter value. That's equal to what's sometimes called the Yamada polynomial of the dual graph, and then we have to add a vertex of a factor of d to the number of vertices of the graph, or this would be the number of regions of the dual graph.
What was Yamada doing? I mean,
I don't know. I just know. I mean, Greg tells me this thing's called the Yamada polynomial.
Okay.
I just needed a name for it. So, but it's maybe, you know, maybe there's a better name. But by Yamada polynomial, I mean, take a graph. Every time you put an edge, you basically, in the terms of Liu's talk this morning, put a little 2 beside it. So it means we've got this 2 temporal leap strands with a projector on it. And when we get to a vertex, we hook them up in this fashion. I think usually when people talk about the Yamada polynomial, they assume everything's trivalent. And so I'm maybe talking about a slight generalization where if you have vertices that are more than trivalent, you put them up in that pattern. Okay, so that's a little review of deletion contraction. Now, part two of the talk. hard hexagons in the shadow world. I'll explain the shadow part in a minute. So based on what we saw previously, now we have at least two reasons that we would really like to be able to evaluate spin networks with all the labels too, or maybe just more general spin networks.
Sure, yeah, I'm sorry, can I ask a question? You know the deletion contraction rules correspond to temporal leaves, so as you two prior K theories, what if you start with some other GQFTs and then associate some polynomials, would they satisfy deletion contraction rules?
I think you can find it within it, but you would end up with the same link calculus. I mean, this dependent. I mean, those two strands you took, you could make them part of something coming from some other lead group, but you'd be looking at. We're not looking at the full SU2 theory here. We're just looking at this sort of Yamada polynomial piece of it, and that lives inside. It's the same way that within subfactors, the temporal lead algebra comes up no matter what the subfactor pair. Maybe you get some extra stuff, and I think in a similar way. If you took a polynomial based on some other Lie group, it would have sitting inside something looking like this Yamada polynomial, because everything has strands, and if you have strands, you can make these two-strand projector. It's a kind of a robust invariant. So, so I think the answer to the question is yes, you could do it with other things, but no, that's not interesting or surprising if you can. I'm going to be assuming that our graph is trivalent. We want to evaluate the spin networks. And why? Well, one, because of quantum computation, we're just interested in them. But also, suppose we could calculate these things really well, and then we could maybe say when they're positive or not. Well, then we would be able to say something about positivity of the chromatic polynomial. So we'd maybe have an alternate proof of the four-color theorem, or we'd say, I think it's still unknown whether the chromatic polynomial is positive in the region between 4 and 5. we're interested to evaluate these things. And so it turns out there's an interesting way to evaluate, and this is called, the shadow world state sum or the Torrey-Bureau state sum. And you can take a graph. Here's my graph, and I'm going to label all the edges by 2, but this will remain true if I put arbitrary labels on the edges. And now I want to also label the faces with integers. And by restricted face labelings, I mean this face at infinity should get to 0 or trivial label. And then once I have a labeled picture like that, so this is going to be, I'm going to sum over all such labelings, and then I can look at each vertex. Around a vertex, I see 6 different labels, and they form a tetrahedron in a natural way, and so I just take the evaluation of that tetrahedron. This is some normalization of 6J symbol. And then at each edge, I see 3 different labels. Here it's 2, C, and D. And so then I can take this theta symbol, label with A, B, and C, and take its inverse. And finally, for each face, I have a label. I just take the circle means on the loop value for that label. So choose a labeling, and then we take a product of a bunch of local terms, and that gives the evaluation. I think, is this like Kirillov and Reshetykin? Were they the first people to write this down?
Well, Kirillov and Reshetykin wrote down shadow world formalism, right? They weren't doing dry theorem there.
Okay.
And then Linz and I used a version of Shadow World to write down these things.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, so I should say there's a book by Kaufman and Linz which is very useful if you're interested in doing this kind of thing. It's kind of stuff we was talking about in a lot more detail. We could also, if we don't like the fact that we're treating this vertex, this outer region differently, we could sum over all possible face labelings of the same thing, but then we'd have to correct by a factor of the sum of the squares of the quantum dimensions of the different projectors.
Sir, I is what? I is indexing what?
I is going over all possible way, so. Yeah, so this actually for generic D is
the line, the line is the label two there.
More specifically that term would be one over sum over I of quantum dimension I squared or I equal whatever set of labels you're using. So for generic D this would be an infinite sum and it wouldn't make sense. But if you're at a root of unity and you have kind of a finite cutoff.
So in the both smaller, for instance, is the what?
I don't know.
I
think Q minus one. I mean, that's what. Sum of D.
One plus tau squared.
Yes, so far you haven't. There's been only one D in your talk so far.
D sub I. We have a projector like this. This is D sub I.
It's that I. Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Sorry.
Usually mean something else by D. Okay. So it's for I particles.
Yeah.
Because one of the PRs
is capital delta sub.
Right. Okay. And then in one of the, that's right, when you set one of the Jones-Wenzel projectors to zero, that's what truncates the sum.
Yeah.
Great.
Okay. So I have okay, so it's interesting to look at, hexagons in the shadow world. one joke of the talk. Okay, so what happens if we let if we're in the Fibonacci category case? So D is equal to the golden number, and we can restrict our labels to just this two label and a trivial label. And then we can't really have two regions next to each other labeled by zero because then we'd have a triple 0, 2, 0, and that's not admissible. You would just get zero. So it turns out that we're summing over configurations of these polygons here, but they're not allowed to touch each other. And in this paper of Fikowski et al. That has been mentioned elsewhere, you look at that, and if you normalize the vertices to the unitary normalization, it turns out you get the hard hex, and if you do it on a hexagonal lattice, then you get the hard hex and Gamow-Lewis criticality or something like that. So it just seemed to be a nice, so here we have these sums coming from topology, and these certain values give things that have already been studied in physics. So we might think more generally, suppose D is general, no restrictions, and so our label set is all the even integers. But adjacent faces can only differ by -2, 0, or 2. And so we end up summing over configurations of that, which suggests some kind of height model. Kind of contours. You have these regions where all the face labels are the same, and then they can go up or down by this bounded amount.
So what does the meaning of the edit when two of the faces have the same label?
It's still labeled by two. It's just one of the terms in our, we're evaluating this thing by subbing over all these labels. One admissible label is to put a two everywhere. And we could have a two everywhere in some force. So we have to, the edges are there and the local terms in that expansion are there even when on face. So did that answer the question?
There was a difference in the label between the faces.
Yeah, so if you have adjacent faces and an edge, they can either stay the same, that would be the case.
Because for spin one, SC can be zero.
Right,
so this is, these normalized SC 0 plus or minus 2. So that means, think of these as part of the, just think of this as angular momentum rules, right? So each of these also represents a representation of some SZ. Of, I guess, his 2, 4, 6 in SZ language would be, you know, 1, 2, 3. And so when you have a spin 1 particle, it can separate vacua of suits, yes. And it's some sort of, this is known RSS model, when you impose the Jones-Wenzel projector that you're allowed to impose for whatever particular value of D you've got, then that'll, you can truncate this pipe model. And in fact, that happens for the hard hexagon model. It's not unrestricted. It's restricted to just a few values.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a known Basler Baxter thing that's known.
Okay, so it has so what I didn't know when I was preparing the talk is whether, you know, starting from this shadow sum type, has anyone made explicitly the connection between, you know, looking at these coefficients and seeing at what parameter regime of these, what do you call them, ROS models?
RSOS. Well, Baxter and Company don't think about it the way you do, but I guess, yeah, they,
okay.
Yeah. They have explicit expressions for the Boltzmann weights. So.
Okay. So one should check, and here we have explicit expressions for the weights. And one should,
right, right. So they
so graduate students should see if they get the same expression.
You know, it's a 10-minute, it's actually a 10-minute thing.
Okay.
I know that paper, and that's completely. No, sorry.
Okay. So it doesn't have to be a hexagonal lattice. It could be any lattice with trivalent things. These pictures last night. And you could have even an irregular lattice, and there's still a model in these perfect sense. Okay.
Does any other case reduce to models that people have studied for other reasons that you know? But obviously on regular lattice, any other regular lattices reduced to models that you know that people have studied?
I don't, but I haven't looked into it. I'm kind of suggesting it.
Sorry.
Something for someone else to look into. Okay, so now we come to the third part of the talk, which is, you know, so where do you, I wrote down that I just pulled the sum out of the air, so how do we know that's true? You know, how would we derive similar things? So that's what I want to go over in the remainder of the talk. In topology, since the 80s, there are a lot of different state sum things. We've got the Thuraya-Vero state sum, which Greg mentioned, related to what I just put down. There's this Russian-Tegan-Thuraya surgery formula, which can be thought of as a state sum. There's this Crane-Yutter state sum for scales of 4 manifolds. You take Dyckgraff-Witten invariants for finite groups, and write them as a state sum over the one skeleton of a triangulation. And then there's also a different Thuraya shadow state sum where he's looking at special spines of 4 manifolds. And what I want to say is that all of these are instances of there's a general construction which these are all special cases of. You know, sort of a machine, you insert some local rules and it spits out like these guys. And more specifically, all these come once you have a TQ of T, and then you want to evaluate on a manifold with a handle decomposition, you're going to get one of these things. So for our purposes, what are the ingredients of a TQ of T? Well, the ingredients are fairly innocuous to start with. We need a top dimension. We need a system of fields, and by one example to keep in mind is this pictures that we draw manifolds, like these temporally bead pictures or other things. But it could also be maps into a classifying space or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But since we're interested in TQFTs, our field object would be either connections on principal bundles for the most part. And more specifically, the field, you know, you should have a functor from manifolds of dimension less than or equal to n into sets, and these functors should be well behaved under gluing and taking boundary. You can axiomatize what it takes for something that qualifies a field for this point of view. But pictures modulo local relations is probably the best example to keep in mind for this talk. And then finally, we need the local relations. And they should be at least as strong as saying if you have two pictures and they're isotopic to each other, then they're the same in terms of the local relation. And you can impose other things as well, like setting temporally viewed projectors equal to zero, that kind of relation. And I should mention that this local relation, you can give a compelling though non-rigorous argument that a local relation is morally equivalent to knowing the action of the path integral. So we're going to construct our TGFTs starting in dimension n, not n plus 1. We'll do n plus 1 later. And instead of an action and doing a path integral over those actions, we're going to have local projections or local relations. And there's no loss of information in starting that part of the theory.
Sorry, stupid question. What does dimension mean? Not space-time dimension.
Yeah, so n is space and n plus 1 is space-time.
Oh, okay. Oh. So, well, you're going to explain how, because I mean, everything you said before basically was talking about just 2D.
Right, so I'm generalizing to arbitrary dimensions, though, if you want to keep the 2 plus 1 dimensional case in mind. Okay, so given those ingredients, more specifically still, let's, if you don't like thinking of the general case, let's think in N is equal to 2, fields on a, say, a 2 manifold are just, temporally Lieb pictures drawn there, and our local relations is this de-isotopy. So the isotopy loops around and we kill true. That by itself will be a pretty interesting example. And the isotopy plus minium may be the finite cutoff, which would be some relation. Maybe we set some projector equal to zero, and which forces the parameter value to be a little bit. So that's a good example. Okay, so if we have the system of fields and local relations, we can form what could be called a skein module. It's going to be dual to it's sort of the dual of the Hilbert space. We'll later see that it is. So we take an N manifold Y. If it's got a boundary, we fix the boundary condition. Then we look at all fields on Y, and if it has a boundary, we insist that they stay with that fixed boundary condition. And then we take finite Cevian linear combinations. And we divide out by local relations. That gives us a vector space. And at this point, it might be finite dimensional, might be infinite dimensional. We can also form categories for an n minus 1 manifold. So to specify a category, you have to give your objects, morphisms, and the composition of it all. The objects are just going to be the fields on the n minus 1 manifold. The morphisms between two objects are just going to be this vector space for the cylinder, which is an N-manifold. So it's going to have a linear morphism spaces. And composition is just given by gluing cylinders together. And so in particular, if our manifold in this example was the unit interval, then we would have a category whose objects are some number of endpoints of arcs in an interval. Morphisms like this. So we just get the temporally Lieb rectangular temporally Lieb category. If it was a circle, the category associated with a circle would be the annular temporally Lieb category. So these cylinder categories are important, one, because they act on these spaces. If you sort of take all these vector spaces and organize, for all values of the boundary condition, and they sort of glue together into a representation of the category. And then in terms of those representations, you can understand a gluing formula for these vector spaces. So that helps you calculate them. And then, I guess for this audience, was that in the n equals 2 case, the particles of our theory are going to be the irreducible representations of the category associated to the circle.
So is there some sort of sense, can you make sense out of the statement that the cylindrical
yes, you can. I'm not going to talk about that, but that's very. So here I talked about a gluing theorem for n manifolds. And the next slide I'm going to be talking about n plus one. But you can also you can construct higher categorical invariants going all the way down to dimension zero. And so in particular, if you know, say, the rectangular Timber-Leib category, there's a sort of a categorified gluing construction that allows you to construct the cylindrical thing in terms of this. And it can be seen that things like the Dirnfeld double are a special case of this more general categorified gluing. I don't want to get into that too much because there's limited time in this talk. Okay, so what about the n plus one dimensional part of our theory? I should say the construction on the previous slide work very generally. It doesn't, it's easy to cook up examples. It might be hard to find an interesting example or one that gives finite dimensional spaces, but it's easy to write down fields and it's easy to write down local relations, and then all the machinery just works. There's no further conditions. But if we want to be able to construct an n plus one dimensional part, then things get a little bit more restricted. So what do we mean by n plus one dimensional part of our theory? Well, we mean some path integral for an n plus one manifold, and that should map fields on the boundary of the n plus one manifold into the complex numbers. In other words, it lives in the dual space. And then once we have this, we can define an inner product on these scheme on these A spaces, scheme modules for an n manifold Y, where we take two fields. And then we just evaluate the path integral of y cross I, and we just sort of stick them on top and bottom. And we want these inner products should be non-degenerate. That's a condition. So now I haven't constructed Z yet. I'm just saying what we would, how do we know when we're done? And then finally, there's a gluing formula. So it's a little bit complicated to state. And one can state it in a more abstract, elegant form than this, but for doing computations, this the more computationally oriented form is what we'll need. So we've got a n plus one manifold W, and we glue it along some manifold M in its boundary. We've got two copies of M. We glue them together to get a glued manifold W sub GL. And then we want to express the path integral of this guy in terms of the path integral of that guy. So path integral is a function from fields into the complex numbers, so let's evaluate the path integral in some field B sub GL on its boundary. And we assume that this B sub GL is gluing of some field B here. And so now we'd like to take the path integral of the cut manifold and evaluate it on the cut version of B, except we've got two new pieces of boundary and we don't have any fields on them yet. And so we just sum over an orthogonal basis. The fields there. So EI runs through an orthogonal basis of this vector space A of n, and we plug these in, and then we renormalize by that factor there. That's the gluing formula. And if it's sort of the only thing you could write, it's the only reasonable thing you could write down for the gluing formula. So here's the theorem. All those other state sums. But suppose we have a system of fields and local relations. So we have a sort of a nice TQFT, except this missing is n plus one dimensional part. And we want to see if we can define that compatibly. So we'll choose a little z in the dual space of the scheme module of the n sphere. So this is a candidate. We're thinking of this as being the path integral of the n plus one ball. I think the moral of this is if you know how to do the path integral on an n plus one dimensional ball, then all the rest is combinatorics. And you can just sort of bootstrap your way algebraically from that. That's the basic idea. So this candidate path integral for the n plus one ball has to satisfy the condition that it gives non-degenerate inner products on these spaces. And then we also assume that these things are finite dimensional. That formula I wrote down is a sum over basis, so it's not even going to make sense if we had an infinite dimensional space for an n-manifold. So if those two conditions are satisfied, then there's a unique partition function z such that its value on the n plus one ball is this thing we started with. Okay, so how do we prove that? Well, this is the outline of the proof. This little z, the thing we chose, gives us an inner product on the vector space for an n-ball for any possible boundary conditions. And that means if we start with so we want to build a manifold up by starting with balls and adding handles of various indices. So if here's sort of a neighborhood of the zero skeleton and manifold, just a bunch of disjoint in balls, and now I want to add a one handle. Here, well, what's the ruling region? What we're ruling along is an n-ball. So these are copies of run. The n plus one, and then glue. Along the n. And so if we go back to the gluing formula, in order to glue along a manifold n, we have to know the inner product. That manifold in. And that's exactly what Z gives us. So we know how to glue one handles, so we know how to calculate that. Once we know how to glue one handles, then we can compute the path integral of Dn cross S1, because that's just, if we just take a single zero handle in ball, and we glue a handle onto it. Dn cross S1, which is of course also D minus 1 cross S1 cross I. Why do we write it that way? Because in our formula for the inner product, in order to know the inner product on Y, we need to know the path integral of Y cross I. So, so now we can compute the inner product on this space. But in that, this manifold, Dn minus 1 cross S1, is in turn the attaching region for a two-handle, and we just bootstrap our way up. So it's sort of clear from this that if there does exist a path integral to satisfy this, it must be unique, because once we chose the value for z of the n plus 1 ball, there were sort of no choices left for us. The gluing formula and the inner product formula fix it by that. And so going through this construction, one, we want to make sure that the gluing formula always makes sense, so we need non-degenerate inner products, and we need these spaces to be finite dimensional. And that's the conditions in the theorem. And if those are satisfied, these also imply semi-simplicity of the categories. And then we just need to show invariance under handle slides. That's trivially easy, and invariance under handle cancellation, which is not too hard. And then we're done. We've defined part of this. And I should point out, the experts in the audience, that even though this is done in terms of a cell decomposition or triangulation, I didn't have to show invariance under anything like the Pockner moves or Elliott-Beaton-Hardin identity or anything like that. This is, it's just this handle cancellation, which is a much simpler thing to check. So,
question: is this degenerization of the relation between John Simon and 2 plus 1 dimensions and always with the 1 plus 1?
Sometimes you see a statement that any modular functor, in the sense of Moore and Seiberg, corresponds to some TQFT, written Reshetnikin Tribe construction. This is a statement like that in a more general context. But I'm not constructing a whole other, 1 plus 1 dimensional theory in 2 plus 1. So,
another analogy to say there's a old paper by Illitzer, Moore, Schwimmer, and Seiberg, sort of a follow-up to Moore, Seiberg, where they're trying to address a Hamiltonian formulation of Chern-Simons theory, so to do the way physicists think, the pictures are identical to what you drew, right? And so instead, start with two-dimensional space and then, propagate in time, so call the direction around your torus. So what you're calling the boundary, let's just call space, and then we want to built up the whole path integral that you're building up, basically by just propagating your space through time, and then we have periodic Euclidean time. So then you got your nice. That sounds like, that's the same spirit. Is that right? Is that the same spirit?
I think maybe that is the same sphere, but I guess, I mean, you know, there's different ways to approach these invariants and sort of, you know, aesthetic choice behind this is I'm trying to keep things as combinatorial as possible, so I'm not writing down any Hamiltonians or actions or things like that. I'm trying to keep it in a different area of math.
Yeah, well, the trick there is the Hamiltonian is zero. That was why their problem was that there's constraint. That there's constraints. That was the tricky part. Which
okay, yeah, so maybe that does sound like it might be simple.
Oh, but Kevin, this is only true for the double theory, right? This is the pickup theory.
I'll get to that later. You can construct the Resch-Deegan derived theories this way as well.
This way.
It is a more indirect construction. But yeah, so far there's no central extension or framing anomaly, so at first glance, you would think you could construct derived Fierro-style theories or double cell theories this way. But I'll address that later. Okay. That's general theorem, but we haven't yet said how these state sums pop out of that, so I thought I'd just go through it in an example. Let's take, this is the example I wrote down here. We have n equals 2, fields on multi-curves and localizations of d-isentropy. So we're in this Kaufman bracket, temporally leave, SD2 world. And then the first thing we might like to do is compute inner products for vector spaces associated to the disk, or the two ball. And we can take our boundary conditions to be three labels A, B, and C. And then there's just a one-dimensional space, and you know, for a more general spherical category, I'd also have to label these trivalent vertices with something, but I'm going to ignore that complication here. One thing I should have said here, the theorem starts out by choosing a candidate z. So what is this little z? It's a function from pictures on the two-sphere into the complex numbers. In other words, we see a picture, we have to spit out a number. Well, that's just the value. We just take, there's an obvious choice there. We just take the usual valuation to start the whole thing. So our starting point, in some sense, the path integral is just the fact that we can evaluate pictures on a two-sphere. So we have these two pictures, we glue them together to get a picture on the two-sphere, it's a theta graph, and then we evaluate, and that's just a number of A, B, C that our theory gives us. So that's the inner product on the two-ball. Now, if we go to the gluing formula, when we glue a one-handle, so I should have repeated the gluing formula here so we could refer back to it, but there was a term coming from evaluating the invariant on the manifold cut open, and so that's up here, and we get a factor of theta. This is theta in the numerator. And then we had to divide by one over the norm squared of our basis element. This is our basis element. Here's this norm squared, but we've got two of them, so we have to put two of these denominators. So it means when we glue a one-handed, we should get a factor of some theta symbol inverse. Remember that theory error shadow sum I wrote down had theta inverses in it, so this is looking promising. I'm skipping some details here, but now we'd like to look at inner products on S1 cross I, and it'll be enough to consider S1 cross I with empty boundary conditions, so none of the strands are allowed to touch the boundary. It turns out then that you get in some sense, this follows from this by letting, say, C equal the trivial label that, and the gluing formula that these form an orthogonal, not just an orthogonal, but an orthonormal basis. That if you take the inner product of two pictures like that, it's one, A and B are equal, and zero otherwise. So now, since we know inner products on an annual, so we know how to glue a two handle, so what do we do? So here's our picture. And it says, sort of rewriting our general gluing theory. Formula for this special case that the glued manifold M union a two handle evaluated on some field X is the same as the cut manifold. So the cut manifold consists of M and this two handle up here, but a two handle is also just a three ball with its boundary decomposed in a certain way. Evaluated on this. And so this D sub A, which is what I wrote down and erased over there, is the quantum, is capital delta sub A. It's just the evaluation of that picture. That's what this contributes, and so we get a factor there. And then there'll be a term of 1 over the norm squared of our basis elements, but for the two handles, those are just 1. So that means if we three manifold, we're gonna be summing over, you know, every time we have a tube handle, it's gonna add to our summation, we have to sum over possible labels there. And if you wanna know the inner product on a two sphere, so the two sphere is just a one dimensional space, and it's a, you can take as a basis element just the empty picture. And so what's the product of the empty picture with itself? Well, that's the path integral of S2 cross I evaluated on the empty picture. Should have drawn that in there. And that's, we can cut S2 cross I into a three ball and a two handle and apply a gluing formula where, I guess, I'm applying the previous thing where M is equal to a three ball. And we just get a sum of a three ball evaluated, a loop with label A, VA, so it's the sum of D sub A squared. So this means that when we glue a three handle, we get a factor of 1/norm² of this picture, which is 1/ something else fit in. So if we put that all together, if we take a three manifold and it's got a generic handle decomposition, dual through triangulation, then we can evaluate it in this sense. We take wavelengths over the two handles for reasons I just gave. And then each zero handle is left with a kind of tetrahedral pattern after we cut away the three, two, and one handles. One handles give factors of theta inverse with, you know, with labels given by this labeling. As I said before, there's this factor of D sub A from the two handle gluing formula that I wrote down. And finally, if there are three handles, then we get this factor of 1 over the sum of the squares of the column dimensions. I think I have time, to go back to that shadow sum. I said the shadow sum could be, it's a shadow sum, or it's also called a triviro. So let me just go backwards and, show why those are the same. So if we have a picture like this, so that I just give this triviro style formula for evaluating, you know, any three manifold with a cell decomposition, and that I did it for closed three manifolds, but if we had a three manifold boundary, that was an easy generalization. And so in particular, we could evaluate it on the three ball with an interesting cell decomposition. So if we have first, kind of by choice, that we have a graph and we want to know the sort of standard evaluation of this graph, that's the same as evaluating the path integral of the three ball with this on the boundary. So now let's choose a cell decomposition of the three ball. Well, we could just choose a single zero cell, and then we're back, you know, we haven't made any progress, we're just evaluating and we started. Or we could put a zero cell around each of these vertices, zero cell, which is in the boundary a little bit, and then put one handles along each of the edges, etc., and then do a two handle across each of these things, and that's also a way of constructing a three ball. And so if we apply the triviro formalism to the three ball with this cell decomposition and with this graph drawn in the boundary, then we get exactly that. In particular, you know, each edge of the graph becomes a one handle, and so we get a factor of theta inverse, and one edge of the theta comes from our graph label here, and then there's the two cells on the other side. What if we had, but another way we could construct three balls, we could put a two cell at infinity. Now what we've constructed is sort of a neighborhood of the boundary of the three ball, S2 cross I, and so we also have to fill in a three cell in the middle. So that means if we, yeah, the difference between these two expressions is here we have an extra two cell at infinity, which means we have more labelings, but we have a three cell to cancel it out, and that's the factor.
So you could do what you just said as a way of just evaluating this graph without ever thinking about three dimensions.
I think that's the point. What happens, I think, you know, clever people just came up with a space sum, a way to write this. And they just guessed it. So this this formula predates with the TQRTs and all this stuff. And what I'm saying is you could also, instead of just pulling it out of the hat or using your years of experience with spin networks to, you know, see how to do it, you could also proceed in sort of a logical direct fashion. That's, you know, that if you know there's a TQFT, then we can evaluate the TQFT in terms of cutting and gluing, and we end up with the same formula. So I'm getting kind of an ahistorical view of this. But this view, you know, only makes sense if you think about a TQFT. I don't know how to get otherwise. There's probably other tricks you can play, but other than just guessing the right answer. I think also, I mean, just why, if one didn't take a TQFP point of view and say you knew both these formulas, it may not be, you know, what's, you know, why this extra factor, you know, why is it that rather than something
okay,
else?
Yeah.
Okay, so now I'm up to my last slide, which will answer Wong's question. Okay, so we just went through the theorem in the case where we started with a spherical category, or more generally, it could be a two-category. And for example, in subfactors, you know, you obviously have black and white shading, and that can be thought of, you know, the bimodules for a subfactor pair from a two-category that has two objects. And anyway, this works for that case as well. So here's a little table showing which ingredients of fields and local relations we need to which state model. So we just kind of went over this, no, actually we went over the second line, and we got the trivirus sum. Another thing we could do is we could take our field unmappable to be a map into the classifying space of a finite group. That's more or less the same as taking it as a principal G bundle, where G is a discrete group, but it's, I think in some ways it's less, at least, you know, topologists, less confusing to think about maps into a classifying space rather than a bundle. Our local relation is just homotopy of those maps. So our vector spaces are going to be generated by the isomorphism classes of G bundles. And if we go through that the same exercise, you know, sort of that same exercise I went before with the handles, you find that the sum A solution is just over the n and n plus 1 handles, or dually, it's over the 0 and 1 scales of a triangulation. And if you look in the paper, you know, you sort of label the one skeleton of the triangulation by elements of the group, and then around each triangle you require that they add to one, and you add up all those configurations, but then you have to divide for each vertex, you have to divide one over the size of the group, and that gives the sort of, I guess, the untwisted digraphic invariant on triangulation. That's the way to get the twisted one as well. These two. Now, what if we have a ribbon category? Ray was talking about these, where we have crossings. So from this point of view, it's a little bit unnatural to draw pictures on a surface, you know, even if they have crossings, with a ribbon category, because a ribbon category is really a three category, and so we should be drawing three-dimensional pictures. And so what we do is we first construct a 3+1-dimensional TQFT, and then we can derive the Reshetikin triode theory from that. So let me do the first step first. So we've got a ribbon category, that's a three category that has all the right kind of properties. So we're going to make a 3+1-dimensional TQFT that's, I think, probably known to experts. I think it appears in the literature too much, and we'll see that it's more the same information as the Reshetikin triode theories. The relations are just the usual thing, isentropy of our pictures, plus, you know, recoupling, for example. And now we can get three different state sums depending on three different ways of carving a four-manifold up into simple pieces. If we take a generic handle decomposition, do the triangulation, we get what's known as the Crane-Yetter state sum. This was, for those of you who don't know, this was a discovery, I think, in the early 90s, late 80s. There was initially some excitement about it because, you know, hey, a four-manifold invariant. They could define it, but they couldn't calculate it. And I think someone claimed it always came out to be zero, and in reality, it always came out to give the signature of a four-manifold, which at the time was regarded as kind of an unexciting result. You know, oh, you know, just getting a local.
Through a local combinatorial formula.
Through a local, yeah. So the little asterisk is.
This is the complementary thing to say about it.
Yeah, Yeah, which I think that's a very good point, is because I remember when I was in grad school in the mid 80s, you know, people were throwing out, you know, problem, you know, find a combinatorial expression for the Pontryagin class, like a signature of a four manifold, and in some sense Crane and Yoder did it.
But there's a defect, so you need exponents, so you don't get the whole thing.
Yeah, it's only an exponent.
Yeah.
But I think what maybe wasn't immediately realized is that this Crane-Yoder variant, it contains, it's got all the information of the, or maybe that was another defect, is it just gave the Reshetikin-Torivin variant that again. But in particular, if we take the Crane-Yoder, you know, 3+1-dimensional path integral, and we evaluate it on a four manifold, it's only going to depend on W of the Bordism, but that's equal to the Reshetikin-Torivin of 2+1-dimensional T of T evaluated on boundary of W, and then if you drew picture pictures, so it's so that's to answer Juan's question. That's the sense in which I'm actually constructing this Crane-Yoder T of T, that it's really the same as Russian T of T, and the sort of that correspondence you can push lower down into other vector spaces. Another way of constructing four manifolds is just to take a single zero handle and add a bunch of two handles. That's very similar to a surgery presentation of a three manifold. If we do that and go through this formalism, this two handle addition formula, we get exactly the surgery formula that kind of got this whole thing started in the late 80s. Another thing you can do is take what's called a special spine. It's like putting the two handles, instead of being discs, they can be disc bundles over some other surface, so you have to specify the genus of the surface and also the Euler class of the disk bundle, and then and then you assume that, you know, there are three handles. These again aren't much studied, but in Torivin's book he talks about them. And if you go through it for that case, you get the Torivin shadow sum, which is a little different than this shadow sum I talked about earlier. So all these things are really just different ways of computing the same invariant, which is the same thing. And then, again, the point I want to emphasize is that all of this is just an inductive procedure, you know, on handles from constructing TKFTs out of local pictures and relations. So I think that's the end of the talk.